member special. Woo. Mac Power users. Thank you, everybody, for supporting us or somebody else on Relay that gets you to our show. We are the Mac Power users. Been around since 2007. Making everyone nerdy.
It's a long time.
There's a 2009. I should really know
2009.
Yeah. That's sorry. Max Sparky started in 2007. Okay. Anyway, we've been around a while.
Yeah.
And we like to focus on Apple technology, getting the most out of it. And we thought for our member special this year, I'm David, by the way, if you're new to it. And Stephen, you probably never heard of this guy, Stephen Hackett, but he has a little bit to do with Relay FM. And we thought we would talk about the book by Trip Mickey or Mickle called After Steve, which is a book that came out about a month ago about Apple after Steve.
Yeah.
How'd you get to that book, Stephen?
Yeah. So I came across this book in its run up, like in the press. There was a segment or a section printed in the New York Times where Trip Mickle is a reporter. And then John Gruber interviewed him on the talk show. So heard about it through those things. And yeah, it's really interesting because there's so many books about the founding of Apple, right? So just countless books about that time period. There's even a lot of books, none of them are really that good, but if you dig, you can find some about the 90s Apple, right?
Yeah.
Really problematic, like bad... bad times, a string of CEOs, none of whom really knew what they were doing. There's some stuff there, but there has not really, and there's a lot of books about Steve Jobs and his death and like becoming Steve Jobs, I think is the best one. But there hasn't been a book yet really getting into Apple since Steve Jobs passed away, you know, what, 11 years ago now?
Yeah.
And this book is the first one to really break that seal. And immediately it was clear to me, this is the most well-sourced book on Apple I think I've ever read. Like, he has details in here that it makes it very clear he has some really serious sources, either in the company, out of the company, close to people in the story. The level of sourcing just really, really impressed me.
I think at some point he had 200 sources for this book.
Wow.
Which is quite a few. I'll tell you my first reaction when I heard about the book, I saw the subtitle and I don't have it right in front of me. I should, but I think it's something how Apple became a billion-dollar company and lost its soul. What is the exact subtitle of this book? I should know that.
I think that's exactly it, actually. It's okay. It is, okay, so from the Amazon listing, After Steve, How Apple Became a Trillion-Dollar Company and Lost Its Soul.
Yep. Yeah, I got the, it's not a billion, it's a trillion-dollar company. Well, that is what turned me off. In fact, I started writing this negative blog post about it because I'm like, oh, give me a break. Apple lost its soul. Come on. You know, big company, blah, blah, blah. And I thought, oh, wait a second. I'm prejudging something I haven't even read. So I said, I can't write that blog post until I've read the book. So I bought the book with the intention of trashing the book on the website. And I never did that. I feel like the book actually, I don't like the subtitle. I don't necessarily even agree with all his conclusions, but I agree with you. This is such a well-sourced book. It really gave me some context for Apple since Steve, and I'm really glad I read it.
Yeah, so the book is really structured around following Tim Cook and Johnny Ive. And their background and then their relationship. And really, I was struck by sort of how similar their backgrounds are. I mean, obviously, they're very different people, right? But both from like pretty middle class families, from not necessarily the big city, right? And having really having a lot of influence put on them as young people that really shaped them. So with Johnny Ive, it was design and his dad's workshop and being interested in how things were made. And with Tim Cook, that's more of a social justice angle where he talked about it publicly. Neither men are quoted in the book directly as sources, but seeing hate crimes and racism and growing up in a time period in the part of the country where he couldn't be himself. He couldn't acknowledge his sexuality growing up. It shaped both of them into who they are today. And I was really just kind of struck by like a lot of similarities in broad strokes in their stories.
Yeah. And really it sounds like with the title that they're pitting them against each other. I don't think the book really does that. I mean, Tim Cook is the businessman and Johnny Ive is the artist, and there's an inherent tension between those two things.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't really think it comes off as kind of art versus business as much as the title implies.
I agree. There is definitely an element of it, but I don't think it's not the big takeaway for me. The big takeaway for this book for me is how these two men and Apple on the whole dealt with the fallout of Steve Jobs dying sooner than people expected.
Yeah. I mean, it's the Walt Disney problem.
You know,
when Walt died, they said, what would Walt do? And they paralyzed themselves into nearly getting, you know, going out of business, Disneyland or Disney. And Steve Jobs is aware of that. I mean, he was the biggest shareholder in the Disney Corporation when he died. And he had conversations with Tim Cook saying, don't ask, what would Steve do? Figure out what the best thing is and just do it. And I think that's important. Another good part about this book is all the background, like Stephen was saying, not only about, you know, how they were raised, but the pivotal role they played in the rise of Apple during Steve's lifetime. I mean, Apple would not be Apple without Tim Cook's influence on supply chain under Steve. And it certainly wouldn't be Apple without Johnny Ive's influence on design under Steve. So both of these men were absolutely essential in Apple kind of becoming the powerhouse that it is today.
Yeah, that's right. And Johnny Ive was there before Steve came back. And Tim Cook was an early Steve Jobs hire. So they kind of fall on either side of that divide. And Ive was doing interesting things or trying to do interesting things within Apple before Steve showed up. And Steve recognized that in Johnny Ive. And as the book puts it, they became sort of like creative soulmates in a way. Like they could work together and bounce off each other in a way that few people enjoy partnership that way creatively.
Yeah.
Whereas Tim Cook job was Apple is a disaster when it comes to manufacturing and fulfillment, and he completely revolutionized that top to bottom. And you didn't get Apple coming out of the late 90s without both of them doing those things, right? You certainly don't ever get, maybe you get to the iPod, you certainly don't ever get to the iPhone without their input. And really, they're kind of two sides of a coin, right? You have Johnny and the design team making these products, influencing those products. And it's up to Tim's organization to put those in the hands of people, ultimately, at the end of the day.
Yeah, they had to get made, right?
Yeah.
But then you've got this, you know, this nexus event, the death of Steve Jobs, and both of them come out of that differently.
Yeah. Johnny Ive seems like it puts him in a multi-year kind of haze, right? Where he had this person he was so close to for, you know, over a decade, close to 15 years, and suddenly he's gone. And it's both personal and professional loss for Johnny Ive. And then on the Tim Cook side of things, not that Tim Cook is emotionless, but Tim Cook in some ways has the harder position where he has to prove to Apple and the world that he was the right guy to be CEO after Steve, right? He has the biggest business shoes to fill maybe ever. And he has to hit the ground running with that while dealing with his own grief in his own way. I mean, it comes up in this book. It's come up in other books where Tim, when they were all at Infinite Loop, Tim never moved into Steve's old office. They basically just left it as it was. And Tim would go in there sometimes, or Johnny would go in there sometimes. But it was like a sacred place, right? And so Tim dealt with his grief as well, but sort of the outcome of that was different, I guess, because the two men are very different.
And there are, you know, complaints, or I don't know if complaints is right. There are issues we can have with Tim Cook's Apple. We talk about it on the show all the time. But it's clear to me that he really owned up to being the CEO under his terms. I think it would have been way too easy for him to try and be Steve. I mean, wasn't that kind of the problem? I mean, you're the historian of the two of us, but wasn't it Scully who fired Steve and then decided to make the Newton? Wasn't it Scully who was behind that?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, okay, I got rid of Steve Jobs. I'll be Steve Jobs. I'll make the Newton. And of course it shipped with bad software and became a laughing stock and everything else. Tim Cook never made those mistakes. You know, he said, okay, I am going to continue to run the business, and the creative stuff is going to be done by Johnny Ive. I mean, Johnny did have a lot of authority in that company. In fact, he got more authority during Tim Cook's reign, not less.
Yeah. So Jobs had sort of the unique position where he was the editor at Apple. And that's a term that's been used for a long time about Steve Jobs. That's not unique to this book. But the idea is that he was the taste maker and sort of the final decision maker, working in conjunction and sometimes against Johnny Ive, right? Sometimes being the buffer between the design group and the rest of the company. And I think, to his credit, although it did have ramifications, Tim Cook knew he didn't have that skill set, that he wasn't that person. And so what you see is, instead of Tim stepping into that role and coming side by side with Johnny Ive like Steve had been, he basically lets Johnny Ive kind of take over both sides of that relationship. And, you know, this is during the early days of the Apple Watch being developed. And there's a lot of talk in this book about that. That's all really interesting. This is also when Apple Park begins to get underway. This is when Johnny Ive is promoted eventually to chief design officer. And you see in the book, Johnny Ive is treated more like another employee than maybe he was under Jobs, right? As his responsibility grows, we know very famously Scott Forstall is ousted. That's talked about in the book. And Ive's team takes over software design as well. Like, he's suddenly a manager of a lot of people. And this small design lab of 24 people or whatever it was, is suddenly a much bigger organization. And suddenly Johnny Ive is a manager and not a designer. And that doesn't do anything to help his state of mind or his desire to stay at Apple. And I think it was the right move for Tim not to move into that role, because he knew he didn't have those skill sets. But it did leave Ive sort of out in the wind a little bit. And I don't know how any other way it could have gone, but clearly he needed that relationship that he had with Steve. And it just wasn't the same once there wasn't a creative partner.
Yeah. I think it really was tough for Johnny. I was thinking about, there's a great story about one of the famous Imagineers, Raleigh Crump, was kind of like the Johnny Ive of his time in Disney Imagineers. He designed many of the attractions at Disneyland and Disney World. And after Walt died, a lot of things changed for the worse. And there's this famous speech he was giving to new Imagineers. He's like, you missed it. Walt's gone. You know, you missed it. It's not the same. And I feel like Johnny was like in that place where like he had his partner. They ate lunch together all the time. They took walks in the park. And the book goes to great detail of how they artistically inspired one another. And Steve would go down to the design studio frequently. And, you know, and he had like a ritual. Like, one of the things he did was he would never lift the black cloths off the, you know, if you go in the design studio, this is kind of known if you see press accounts. There's a bunch of tables with things on them that have black cloths over them, you know?
Yeah.
And Steve would never lift them off. He was Steve Jobs. He could have looked at anything he wanted in there, but instead he wanted them to lift the cloths and like have their moment to share what they were working with him and tell the story. and the exact opposite. The way they portray, Tim Cook's visits to the design studio were very infrequent. And when he did, he always looked bored when they started talking about why it had a chamfered corner or something. Mm-hmm. He just, and I don't know how true the book is, but the way it's portrayed in the book, it's like the polar opposite of the way Steve Jobs would react to this.
Yeah, Jobs seemed to have a real reverence for the design team and their space. And there's examples in the book about suddenly people who didn't have access to that part of Apple's campus suddenly have access. And suddenly people who in the past would never, ever stand up against design and say, well, you can't do that because of expense or something else. Suddenly those people had the ability to do that. And again, it's just like a changing landscape as the leadership changed. And I think some people have read this book or really this book and come away with Tim Cook's the bad guy, poor Johnny Ive, hashtag pray for Johnny. And I think the reality is that neither of them really knew how to handle this new world. And that's compounded the fact that they were both grieving, and you got to show up to work the next day, right? Like, Apple is too big of a company to coast for any amount of time. And so you're under this pressure to do the next big thing. And that's what a lot of this book talks about, but also just like keep things running, right? To do the day-to-day stuff. And like, we've all been in those situations where like you're dealing with something personal, as these men were, and it's hard, right? And so I don't read this and think, gosh, Tim Cook's the bad guy, nor do I read it thinking Johnny Ive's the bad guy. I think they didn't know how to adapt to this change, and by the time they kind of figured it out, it was too late. And, you know, I think the Apple Watch, at least the way this book is structured, the Apple Watch is the critical point in all of this, where Johnny Ive wants it to be this fashion object, right? They made a solid gold version, for crying out loud. It's $10,000 starting price point. And he is off like jet setting around the world, talking to fashion magazines and being in fashion shows with this watch and like talking about it, where a lot of people at Apple viewed it as a computer on the wrist, right? And it's so interesting because we can see that, right? If you rewind and watch the fall 2014 event where they announced the Apple Watch, and then in March 2015 when they sort of go back over it, and that's when they actually gets a release date and prices, the tension is public. We're like, yeah, like it does some fitness stuff. Yeah, it does some computer stuff. But we're selling it in these tiers with these finishes, and we have these videos about the stainless steel we're using and the gold we're using. And that just didn't sit well with a bunch of people who actually worked on the product, right? But that's the direction Johnny and the design team wanted it to go in. And so you see, I mean, the fact that the gold watch made it out the door, like, that tells you that I've got what he wanted, right? Like, I don't think Tim Cook was super psyched about that Apple Watch. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I get a feeling he wasn't. But Johnny was, and so it happened.
Well, I think Tim Cook did defer a lot to him. You know, I mean, he gave him, you know, the software job too. And I do think that, you know, what's it, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, you know. Giving him all that authority is what led to giving him more management, which is what kind of helped burn him out. So it was... Yeah. You know, all these weird things working against each other, but they were two different sides of the coin, like you said, and they were both very driven with good intentions. And who's to say that Steve Jobs, if he were alive, could run Apple better than Tim Cook could at this point? I mean, it's a very different company, you know, as they're dealing with regulation challenges and politics and all this other crazy stuff that Apple has to face now. Would Steve Jobs' temperament be good for that? I don't know. You know, maybe it would. I just don't know. But the fact is, he's not here, and Tim Cook does have these problems that he didn't face. And you know, the another interesting underlying theme. There's a couple themes that I want to make sure we cover before we wrap up. The theme of what's the next big thing for Tim Cook, you know, because Steve got the phone and the iPad and everybody's like, well, Apple can't innovate. And that was the Apple Watch. And one of the book's conclusions is that the new innovation from Apple is the services, you know, that that towards the end of the book, that becomes a running theme, how Tim Cook has figured out a way to make the company more valuable by adding services.
Yeah.
And this is a thing that frequently comes up on our show, the 5 gigabyte thing. I mean, I keep saying it, but you know, Apple has been giving away 5 gigabytes of free data longer than the Beatles were together. You know, every competitor gives you more data than Apple, but they charge you and they make money for services by charging you. And so there's some stuff going on.
And in the book, Ive is very against the push to services. You know,
sure,
he's dismayed by it. I think is actually a word that that Tripp uses in the book. And yeah, this move away from like beautifully crafted devices to services is something that, like, in a way, that downplays the importance of hardware design. You know, in reality, yeah, that's not what has happened. I would argue that Apple's hardware design is better than it's been in a long time, but the fear is there, right? That if we just become a services company, it doesn't really matter like how amazing the next iPhone looks.
Yeah, and one of the conclusions I got out of the book, I don't know that he made it, that he made this a conclusion, but something that I took away is just the insidious nature of Wall Street. You know, and one of the points, so for years, Apple stock was undervalued and compared to its competitors. If you look at the amount of money they made versus the price of their stock, it was always really low in comparison. And he explains in the book, the reason for that is because Apple was a hit-based company. And so the stock was devalued because people thought, well, what if the next iPhone's a dud? Then they're not worth anything. Whereas companies that sell services like Google and some of Apple's competitors had like a recurring revenue stream that allowed you to put more value in their stock. And as soon as Tim Cook started adding services, Apple's stock went through the roof. That's why they're a $1 trillion company. That's why there's a T in the title instead of a B.
Yeah.
So he was the one that engineered that, and that's all good. But this whole thing, this treadmill with Wall Street, I just hate it because, you know, later in the book, he's talking about how Apple's looking at like medical services and cars and like all these industries that they don't currently do, because the only way they move the needle on Wall Street now is to do something like invent a car or change the way healthcare is managed, because just making a MacBook Pro better isn't enough for them. It doesn't make a difference to Wall Street. And to me, that's the fear of Apple now. I mean, all these Apple fans worry about Apple going away because they're going to go out of business because they remember 1995. That's not the fear. The fear is that Apple isn't going to go out of business. It's that they're going to move on so far beyond what we care about that we're not going to like what they are anymore.
Yeah. And I think that fear is baked into the book's premise, right? And
yeah,
I think a lot of people, when they read this, will sort of sympathize with Ive as he kind of moves further and further out in his orbit from center. Like there's a meeting described in the book where it's sort of a pivot for the Apple Watch to fitness. All right. Again, something we saw in public with the Apple Watch, right? Around the Series 3, they were like, hey, turns out this is an awesome fitness tracker. And they've just gone down that road as fast as they can ever since. The right move for the Apple Watch, I would argue.
And something we were calling for at the time as podcasters, saying we don't want a $20,000 watch. We want it to be a better computer watch. You know,
yeah,
we were asking for it. You
know? Yeah. And Ive isn't in the room when the decision's made. He's off doing something else. And eventually what happens is, as we know, he leaves. Design sort of loses its head seat at the table. And now you have Jeff Williams, who is the COO and CEO in waiting, probably, even though he and Cook are basically the same age. He came in with the Apple Watch, and he's working with a design studio. It's a different situation than it was under Jobs. And we have Alan Dye and Ellen Hinkey and other people doing design at Apple now. And again, I think for the most part, they're doing good work, especially on the hardware side, but it's just fundamentally different. Does that mean Apple's lost its soul in the way? I don't think it does. But
yeah, I agree.
But I think viewing the last 10 years of Apple through the lens of these two men is the right way to view it. If you're talking about corporate stuff, right? Like, this book doesn't really get into that much about what Apple's done with social justice and human rights issues. And like, that's a whole separate book that I think will be written at some point. But like Apple becoming effectively a nation state, and you have Tim Cook trying to walk the line between China and the Trump administration. Again, some of that's in this book, not a ton of it, but it's a very different world now. And I think if Apple's ever going to lose its soul, quote unquote, like, it's not going to be because the designer who was there for a long time left. It's going to be these bigger, more structural things, to your point.
Agreed. And honestly, in a lot of ways, I feel like Apple has found its soul with the way we've had this resurrection of the Mac or renaissance of the Mac. And it feels to me like the things I'm worried about are just worries at this point. They're not legitimate based on what we've seen in the last few years from Apple. It seems like there's plenty of people that really get it and are working on it, and Apple is shipping good stuff. But, you know, just get back to the fact it's a trillion-dollar company, and when you're on Wall Street, you need to, every 90 days, you got to prove your worth, and that leads to some weird decisions. It does not make me a fan of services. I'll tell you, that's one thing I came, and I'm not blaming Tim Cook for it. I understand why he's doing it. That's probably what I would have done too in his shoes, but you know, this general push towards services does leave me feeling leery.
Yeah, they've got to do it in a way that I think strikes a better balance than they've done so far. I mean, the 5 gigabyte thing is just basically a crime at this point.
Yeah, that's a poster child is what it is.
It is. You know, I mean, it is. But I think if you look at services like Apple Music or iCloud Photos, like for the most part, they do what they say they're going to do. And you know, I think Apple Music is maybe you can have quibbles about the UI and the music app, but like it's a solid service. Like they're doing good work in this area. But then you also have things like News Plus, which isn't really that successful. And now you have them moving more into financial services, which feels the most out of step with where they've been so far. And they've even expanded upon that, you know, this summer with some of the buy now, pay later stuff, which like I personally don't really like, and I wish they wouldn't do. And that's what I think we got to keep an eye on and see how far they're willing to go down that road. And it's fine if they do that and it's like in a silo. It's when those things begin to impact the experience of the user that I start to worry. And that's, I think, what we all keep our eye on.
Okay, so two stories from the book. Think of two stories from the book, one about Ive and one about Tim Cook that made you giggle or made you note. I'll go first since I didn't tell you we were going to do this.
Okay.
One of my favorite stories about Johnny Ive was his relationship with his father, which is recurring throughout the book. You know, when he first was interested in design as a child, his father made him do things the old school way, like he had to draw, you know, all the designs he wanted to do, and his dad would let him build. And like a treat for him was a day in the shop together to make something. I just love that. My dad and I had a relationship like that with woodworking, where I had to like learn the hand tools from him. And it reminded me of that so much. I didn't have my dad as long as Johnny did, but it really got me that whole relationship. And it was throughout the book. I loved that. And the funniest thing about Tim Cook in the whole book that I thought was funny was when they were buying Beats and Dr. Dre, it was a very secret transaction. It was $1 billion deal. I think it was a $3 billion deal or something. It was just a lot of money, and everything had to be very secret. And, you know, they'd been told not to say anything. And Dr. Dre like did a Facebook video where he started talking about it or referencing it, you know, and Jimmy Iovine just lost his mind because he thought he was going to cost him the $1 billion deal. And then they got summoned to Apple and Tim Cook got him in a room and he negotiated like another 300, you know, million off the price. You know, I just love that. That made me laugh. I don't know. It's like, okay, you broke the rules. Now it's going to cost you a bunch of millions.
Mm-hmm. So for me, it sort of jumped out at me like the Johnny Ive on the construction site, like wearing a hard hat and like building Apple Park, which we were just in and was beautiful, how he just like really went over every detail. Like what do the door pins look like inside the door jams and like these chairs that we're building for, I mean, and sort of how some of that hit the wall, you know, it was like, oh, if you have glass everywhere, people run into it and the echo was really bad. Like some of that just kind of made me chuckle, like just design meeting the real world. But I liked all that, 'cause, you know, my parents are both in construction. I grew up around it my whole life. Like, so I was gravitated towards that, and being at Apple Park and seeing it, it's like, holy cow, how did this even happen? But the other thing, so the thing about Tim Cook is, and it's not necessarily new in this book, but it's sort of, it's drawn in contrast to Johnny Ive's lifestyle, where he is meeting with fashion people and he has a private plane that is like amazing and all these things. And like Tim Cook was still flying commercial and then had like a security incident at an airport. And then they like made him, like the company made him fly privately after that. Like, and yeah, I think Jeff Williams,
very frugal.
Yeah. I think Jeff Williams has a lot of that too. Where like Jeff Williams very famously like drove an old Toyota forever. Maybe still does, but you know, very wealthy. He could drive anything he wanted to, but he had a Camry, so that's what he was going to drive. Like, sort of the down to earth, and it's because of his roots, right? Like, I get it. You know, I'm not from a small town, but I'm from the South. Like, a lot of that is cultural here, right? Like, sort of being frugal, being not showing your wealth, and the contrast between the two. You know, it's just different choices, right? But it sort of made me chuckle when those examples would come up about Tim.
Yeah, I think if you do read the book, don't read it as a Johnny versus Tim. Try not to take that mindset. I feel like the title kind of puts you there. But yeah. I also know a lot of times when you make books, publishers insist on a sexy title to get the book sold. Mm-hmm. And I'm not even sure Tripp, that would have been his first choice for the title. But I do think that if you're interested in Apple and you want to read a really well-sourced account of what's been going on the last 10 years, I'm not sure there's a better one.
Not yet, at least.